Hey, it's Johnny Jett. Welcome back to my podcast YouTube channel. Today, we have Michael Taylor, who is the practice lead from JD Power, to talk about their 2021 customer satisfaction survey. Michael, welcome to the show, and thanks for your time.
Well, glad to be here.
So, you know, I read this came out a couple weeks ago, and, you know, Miami, JFK, number one and number two for the mega airports were
right.
So, I mean, the only thing I can think of is because the labor shortage and there were places open, unlike a lot of other smaller airports. But come on, Miami and JFK. Have you ever been to these airports?
Of course I have. JFK is basically my home airport. I live here in Stamford, Connecticut.
Oh, I'm from Connecticut, by the way.
Yeah, thanks. So basically, let's go kind of back up a little bit and kind of describe how this survey is done. It's just average travelers. We ask a wide variety of people if they've traveled through an airline in the last 30 days. And if they say yes, they're kind of qualified for one of the JD Power travel studies. And obviously you have to have two airports for every airline trip that you take. And then we sort these things into three different categories because they all have different challenges. So Miami and JFK, as you mentioned, are what we call the mega airport category, which is 33 million passengers and above. To give you an idea, in a normal year, Atlanta does around 110 to 120 million passengers a year. Then we have the next category down, which we call large, and then medium. Medium is about 4 to 10 million, and 10 to 30 million is about the large category. So yeah, it is an unusual year, especially for the mega category. And as I've been telling all our clients and the media as well, that we're just going to see a lot of churn in these rankings for the next 3 to 4 years, simply because the biggest swing factor besides COVID is construction. So when construction happens or doesn't happen, it depresses scores. It's the biggest swing factor in the study. So if you encounter, like, for example, LaGuardia, which generally populates the bottom part of the rankings, unfortunately, although it is the most improved airport in the study this year, with a proviso, which I'll tell you about in a second. You know, they finished a good deal of their construction, but still have a lot left to go. PDX, which is a great airport, usually is the top of its category, which is a large category.
Portland
is below the average because they're tearing up the front half of the airport and a lot of the down terminal or in terminal food, beverage, and retail. And then, as you mentioned, the labor shortage and the swinging COVID traffic. Some airports are doing a lot of traffic. Some are doing as much traffic as they did in 2019. For example, Charlotte is doing over 100% of what they did in 2019, which was a record year for them. And certain airports are down. And if you have fewer passengers in the terminal, you have higher satisfaction. You know, if you're one of 25 people getting on a flight, that's great. If you're one of 250 people, that's not so great. So that's basically how these things happen. Although I will say, in defense of Miami, Miami's been on the climb for about 20 years. And they have really good strengths, especially in the food, beverage, and retail. They really have a good understanding of what their passengers want to eat and buy while they're there. And the same can be said of the other winner in the large category, which was MSY, which is Louis Armstrong New Orleans. Well, they have a brand new airport since November of 2019. That helps. But they also have a fantastic food, beverage, and retail program that reflects the local scene, ambiance, however you want to categorize it. But an airport that has food, beverage, and retail that reflects the local flavor usually does very well in these surveys.
And have you traveled to, I mean, you don't, it's all your customers' reviews, but do you then go and travel and check them out as well? Or
I don't get to all of them. And then we track, you know, in a normal year, we track 66 airports. And I don't get to all, believe me, I don't get to all of them. It just seems that way.
I just looked sometimes at your list. I've been to everyone but one.
Which one haven't you been to?
Raleigh, Durham.
Oh, really? That seems strange because it's a big connector airport.
Yeah,
you know, if, you don't fly American very much then,
no,
I guess.
No, I actually do. I'm an executive platinum on American. So,
How did you avoid RDU then?
I go to Charlotte.
Okay. I see. So, all right. So,
but
yeah.
I agree about Miami Airport. I do love Terminal D. You know, the design is great. The food, I love the Cuban food, Versailles, Cafe Versailles.
Yeah.
Although what I don't like about Miami Airport is that, you know, to get from one gate or to the baggage claim or to another gate, it could be a really long walk. And the people movers are not great in terms of like getting to them as well. I mean, it's a long walk. So, and yeah. It's also always freezing. That airport, you know, you think you're going to be in Miami. It's going to be warm. That airport is colder than any airport I've ever been to.
They have the AC cranked up.
Yeah, they say, yeah. And they actually, I interviewed someone from the airport a couple of years ago before COVID, and they said it was to keep viruses at bay, which is interesting. They're like, that's what hospitals do too. So it makes sense. Yeah. But JFK Airport, I mean, I grew up in Connecticut. Getting to JFK was always way more difficult than flying anywhere because you never know what the traffic's going to be like. The, you know, the terminals are all spread apart.
Well, there, you know, if we prioritize, we have a model that we run everything through to get these scores. The scores are on a 1,000-point scale. The lowest you can get is 100. The highest you can get is 1,000. And a couple things. The highest priority that has the most impact on satisfaction is your interaction with the building itself. How clean is the bathroom? Is like the top one.
Is it?
You know, are there things to do while you're in the airport? You know, entertainment wise, and entertainment includes shopping and, you know, eating at a nice restaurant. And is the gate area comfortable, et cetera, things that you interact with the building. That's number one. Number two is actually getting to the airport, getting off the airport. And one of the things about the mega category is that they're almost always, I don't think there's any exception I can think of, they're all in a big metro area. And so the, you know, the passenger experience is I leave my house or apartment, and I start going towards the airport. Now, the airport can't control the traffic in Boston, and it can't control it, you know, in the New York area, as we all well know, but that's part of the experience that generally holds things back. But they're all somewhat on the same footing. That's why we have these three different categories. You know, the medium airports are in much smaller cities, for example, or they're located in relatively less trafficked area, like Indianapolis is right off the Beltway. I think it's 465, if I remember. You know, and they move the airport from one side of the airfield to the other, and they just have great access to that airport. And it is, Indianapolis is actually the highest scoring airport in the study this year.
Is it? You know, but, I have not been to the new Indianapolis airport. I heard it's great from multiple.
It is. You know, if I know that you sound like a guy who really enjoys good airport design, and it's got great airport design. The features that we see in the J.D. Power data that generally indicates that people are going to have a good time in the airport is that they have enough space when they get to the frontage to unload their stuff, get in the terminal. The ticket counters are relatively have a relatively some good space around them. There's enough space for TSA to operate with all the equipment they have. And so you get through TSA as well. And then, as I said before, the bathroom is clean. Right. And what we see in the data is that if anything is old, worn, or broken, it's always considered to be dirty, no matter how clean it is. You could perform open heart surgery on it, but if it's broken, passengers don't make no distinction between condition and cleanliness. So a new airport or newer building helps you, as does high ceilings, because again, it mitigates some of the noise, makes it feel more open. You know, and this is an architectural concept that the, you know, the Greeks and the Romans and the Italians knew about. You know, if you have high ceilings, people tend to think the space is bigger that they're actually in. And so certain airports, say, for example, Seattle, which has low ceilings, the old Detroit airport, if you remember that, had extraordinarily low ceilings. And so does, for example, an airport like Seattle. And that kind of holds them back in our rankings, simply because people like that big open space. And, you know, and you probably noticed that, you know, the girders and the ceilings are painted white, you know, to give that bright feeling. And then they also have an awful lot of natural light in the building itself. I'm sorry for my dogs barking, but this
Interesting. I mean, yeah. I didn't realize all those things, and it really is true. I mean, I hate low ceilings. I like bright, airy airports. I like new airports. I mean, LAX is, I've always said LAX is one of my favorite airports in America, because especially of Tom Bradley, it's just, I mean, that is one of the best terminals ever.
That is true. And we could talk forever about Los Angeles International Airport, because my company is headquartered in California, so I use LAX quite a bit. LAX suffers from the fact that when it was designed, it was a great idea. It's a horseshoe. You know, it starts Terminal 1, you go around the horseshoe, you get around to whatever Terminal 7 it is, like on the far side, and all the parking is in the middle. That's great when you're doing 25, 30 million passengers a year, but when you're doing 80 or 70, as they do, then it's a nightmare to get access to it. And that's generally the problem. In fact, I was speaking to the ex customer experience officer at LAX yesterday about Sepulveda Boulevard. And, you know, when I look at it, I think that is the worst place to put Sepulveda, right next to Terminal One, you know, which really screws up all the access traffic there.
Right. Were you but here yesterday? Were you in I'm in LA.
Oh, no. I was talking to the ex-customer experience officer, Barbara Yamamoto, yesterday on the phone. She has a new job, so we were chatting about that.
I gotcha.
But, yeah, but with, you know, the design of an airport really does affect it. This is why, you know, one of the common questions I get is, why do the East Coast airports score lower than most other airports? And the simple answer is that they are shoehorned into a very small space. If you think about where Boston is located, there's just no place for them to expand to. Or, you know, for the another one would be, LaGuardia. You know, where is LaGuardia going to expand to? Well, there's other expansion opportunities at LaGuardia. They could tear down the brick buildings, but yeah, hey, they never listen to me.
Right.
So, but most of that happens with most of them. But if you have like DFW, DFW has hundreds and hundreds of acres they can expand into. And that's just not the case for most of the East Coast airports. San Francisco is another one that's shoehorned into a space. San Diego is shoehorned into a space, and they're never going to be able to expand.
But does weather also play a part? Because San Francisco's weather is terrible. Most of the East Coast weather is terrible.
It has a bigger effect on our airline study, where your hubs are located. I used to kid with US Airways, I believe, and Continental back before they were part of United. That you're the only airline crazy enough to put a hub in Newark, which is the world's most complicated airspace. You know, there are basically four airports, when you count Teterboro, that need to be accounted for in the New York area. And when Teterboro has flights out, which is usually late in the afternoon, that just throws a monkey wrench into the air traffic control. And air traffic control has found out long ago the best way to keep planes from colliding in the air is never let them get in the air. And so as you spend a lot of time on the tarmac in the afternoon, and you know, you're probably like me, you game the system and you don't leave at 7 a.m. or 8 o'clock out in the New York market. You wait till 10 or before 4 o'clock. Then you can get on the tarmac and get off on time.
Right. But so is White Plains considered one of the four airports?
No. Well, it's part of the Port Authority system now, but it doesn't that's so far away that air traffic control has its own kind of space, airspace. The other four are so close together, and the way they take off, the way the Teterboro Airport runways are positioned, you know, they're kind of flying into the traffic that, you know, where Newark is departing, has departing flights. So ATC has to control for all of that.
I mean, the New York airports really need direct train service. I know, you know, I've taken the AirTrain, I've taken the M60 bus to LaGuardia, and I know they're talking about LaGuardia getting train service. I think it was just approved. I'm not sure if that's finalized.
But... Well, somebody asked me about this yesterday, and I'm like, well, I've been living out here for 23 years, and it comes up every 5 or 6 years, and it never gets done. But it attracts the most amazing crowd of bankers and investment houses that you've ever seen when they have meetings for this, because it's a multi-billion dollar project to get it done. And then you have the Taxi Liberty Commission, which is very powerful here.
That's what's holding it back.
Yes. They've got a stake in making sure the train doesn't go out to LaGuardia.
Right. It's a joke.
It's an awful lot of revenue for them.
You can't be a world-class city without having, you know, direct train access. I mean, look at Europe, look at Asia. It's just, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, I mean, Hong Kong is an interesting example, because they're in a relatively crowded space, but they moved the airport way the heck out there, and they have a nice train service right along the coast there that makes it very pretty, pretty train ride. But, you know, we're not like Europe in one critical area, which is density of population, which lends itself to train service. And, you know, obviously New York area is densely populated, but, you know, the whole European system is based on the fact that you can't swing a dead cat and not go over someone's border. And so train service is very accepted over there, and it's not here, especially not on the West Coast.
Right. For sure.
Which makes that LAX project, since you're in Los Angeles, that People Mover project, I'm watching that like a hawk, because it, you know, that's a car culture out there. Right. People like to go to the airport in their own car or get dropped off, you know, by their brother-in-law, you know, right in front of the terminal. And they like to drive down the 405 and the 101 and the PCH to get to LAX. And to have them go across Century Boulevard and get on a People Mover over into the center of the airport is going to be an interesting proposition for a car culture like Los Angeles.
For sure. Before 9/11, I used to drive around LAX just for fun, just for to plane spot.
You can't do that anymore.
No, no. I mean, you can't
get this. You cannot do that anymore.
Crowded. There's always cops out there ticketing anybody for anything ridiculous. If you just change lanes wrong, you'll get a ticket.
Yeah.
Although they've been, they've calmed down a little bit lately.
Yeah. Well, you know, that I think you know that the, that People Mover project is going to be the most expensive project in the history of the county of Los Angeles. They're spending that much money, which is more, you know, which includes something like the 405.
Right.
Of course, the 405 was built many years ago, so I don't think there's inflation in the account there. But they are going to spend several billion dollars to try and improve that airport.
It will be.
But they are constricted with the current situation they have. That horseshoe is just not conducive to easy access to the airport.
So before I let you go, do you have a favorite airport yourself? How about internationally, since...
Well, internationally, my answer is always the same, which is Singapore. When we used to do this study internationally, Singapore was always at the top. I used to say, I don't know if Singapore actually makes any money as an airport, but they have determined that they are going to be the world's best airport. And I mentioned bathrooms before as being the critical factor. That's really a signal to how much the airport cares about passengers. And Singapore has a rule that they're never going to have a bathroom, an airport bathroom that's older than 3 years old.
Wow.
No matter what shape, it could be in perfect shape. They tear it out and they build a brand new one because they know that there's that condition and cleanliness go together. And they want to have the world's best airport scores. So they spend the money tearing out bathrooms every 3 years, whether they need it or not.
Well, I mean, anytime you go into a bathroom in an airport in Singapore, or, you know, I think my first time to Abu Dhabi, I think it was Abu Dhabi, maybe Doha, but you walk into these bathrooms and there's an attendant in there and they literally clean between people using it. And there's plenty. I was like, this is nicer than the Four Seasons hotel.
and that is, you're exactly right. I've had the same experience. And, you know, airports have flirted with having those bathroom attendants, but they just can't keep those people employed. Americans just don't want to stay in those jobs very long.
Right.
So they have a hard, they have a really hard turnover in those jobs.
I can't blame you. I wouldn't want that job myself.
But, you know, if we ever chat again, I'll tell you the difference between male and female preferences in bathrooms and what ticks them off, whether you're having to be one sex or another.
I got a couple minutes if you want to say it. I mean, that's sure. I'm interested.
Sure. You know, when we look at all the data that we've done on bathrooms, because it's, you know, such a critical factor, you know, there are two things that have popped up. You know, for females, the most critical factor for them is the countertop free of water and, you know, and any kind of debris, because apparently they like to put their purse on top of that, or they like to put their hands there. You know, they just, it's very different for men. They don't care about the countertop, whether the countertop is dry or clean. They care about suspicious liquids on the floor. That's what really, that's a critical factor for them. And so when we consult with our airport clients, we're like, you know, if you're interested in tweaking your bathroom scores, those are the two critical things to remember, that men want to have a clean and dry floor. Well, women want to have a clean and dry countertop.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I never thought about it, but yeah, I can see.
Well, you know, it's a strange job that I have where I sit and think about, you know, airport bathrooms for a good portion of my day.
And are you traveling a lot now?
No, no, I don't. I'm normally taking 2 or 3 trips every 2 weeks, and now I'm taking 2 or 3 trips every quarter. So, mm-hmm. Yes, I've slowed down quite a bit. But once we get through this, hopefully, knock on wood, last wave of COVID and people start to settle down, we're going to have a regression to the mean and we'll have more business travel.
And where would you go?
Well, I have clients everywhere in the United States, from the West Coast to Florida. I do the airport airline and rental car studies for J.D. Power. So okay. I'm going to Florida for the rental cars. I'm going to be in California the week after next to talk to some airports out there. I spent a lot of time in Detroit at their airport. So yeah, I fly all over. My last trip was actually out to Oregon.
Okay.
And where I, you know, ostensibly went to my niece's wedding in Bend, but then I went down to play golf at Bandon Dunes. So
nice.
That was my last trip that I've taken.
So since you're talking about car rentals, so is the Carmageddon over? I mean, are there...
No, it's not. No, no, no. We're still really, really in deep water here. You know, a couple of things. I think it's probably apparent to all your listeners. You know, that when the pandemic hit and rental car companies sold off their most liquid asset they possibly had, which was their fleet, And since no one had any history, the last pandemic we've had like this was over 100 years ago when there was no such thing as the rental car industry. No one had any idea how many cars they would need coming out of this thing. And of course, everybody would have probably misguessed anyway. And then we had the chip shortage on the OEM and the original equipment manufacturers. They can't make enough new cars because they can't get chips still to actually run the things. Still to this day. So the car companies are stuck. And if you've noticed, the price of a used car has gone up 40% because they're trying to buy back the cars they just sold 7-8 months ago. And the prices have gone through the roof for that. So no, we are not going to be anywhere near in a recovery through the rest of probably the first quarter of next year. They also suffer from the labor shortage. Right. Because we have fewer business travelers who are bypassing the counter, you know, being Gold or Preferred or whatever loyalty program they're in, and they never even talk to anybody. They just get in the car. I mean, they might talk to the woman or the person that has the exit gate. But we have the vast majority of travelers now are leisure travelers, and they're going to the counter. And I made a mistake of not booking myself as Gold. I thought I was Gold when I was renting from Hertz, and this is no knock on Hertz. They won our award 2 years in a row for best rental car company. But I waited with my wife for 48 minutes at the counter in order to get into a $140 a day subcompact, which was more than we were paying for our hotel room in Bend.
Wow. So is it going to be the holidays that they're going to be crunch time? And is it always going to be like in Hawaii? I mean,
Hawaii is absolutely the worst market you can possibly imagine. You've heard the stories of people renting U-Hauls when they get to the airport because they can't find a rental car. And it's very obvious to see why. It's hard to reposition fleet to Hawaii. You know, you can drive a car across the state of Florida. That's no problem to get from, say, Miami to Orlando to have someone rent the car in Orlando. But you can't drive a car out to Hawaii.
Right.
So, you know, the logistics of it make Hawaii easily the worst rental car market in this current environment.
And when do you think it'll be Q1 for Hawaii too?
It'll be past Q1. It'll really be past Q1. The OEMs have such a backlog. The other part of it is just some of the inside baseball stuff is that if you're a fleet, if you're Enterprise, Avis, Hertz, you're buying tens of thousands of vehicles and you're buying it at a very good price because you're, you know, Hertz, or in this case, Enterprise, is General Motors' biggest client. And the OEMs like General Motors are not offering incentives anymore. They're not discounting the cars because they can sell every single one they've got at list price or better. And so the bean counters at all these rental car companies saying, okay, well, if we bought it at this price, we could never rent it long enough or high enough to make it pay off for us. So we can't even buy that. It's just the economics of it. And that's going to persist for quite a while because we don't see any at the moment, any end to the chip shortage at all. There's no horizon we can see. I get that from the automotive folks at JD Power, by the way.
And the chips are made in Taiwan, right?
Taiwan and China. As I understand it.
And OEM stand for? Operator?
Original Equipment Manufacturer. Sorry, that's kind of inside baseball
talk.
Okay,
I'm just making sure.
Yeah, those are the GMs, Toyotas, Chrysler.
Okay.
You know, of the world, Ford, those people. That's what an OEM is, Original Equipment Manufacturer.
Great. Well, Michael, I really didn't think this was going to be that interesting, but.
Well, we'd love to chat with you again.
You surprised me.
Also, you know, next week our rental car study comes out. So,
good. Well,
you want to chat about rental cars again? Yeah.
All right. So, I really appreciate it. And where can people find you if they have any questions or you don't want people contacting you?
You can go to jdpower.com and upper right hand corner, click on business and then it'll say travel. And then you can find all the information there, or they can email me directly at michael.taylor@jdpa.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And hope to talk to you soon about the car rentals.
Yes. Yeah. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right.